right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Millennials, Mormonisms, and Myth. This presentation is sponsored by the Mormon Transhumanist Association. As technology accelerates cultural upheaval, Mormon transhumanists champion prophetic visions of human potential. Please silence your cell phones. This session is being recorded, and you can purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please consider also making donations to Sunstone and subscribing to one of our amazing Sunstone podcasts. This session is 60 minutes long, and we'll ask both the audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. A little about this session. With rates of religious non-affiliation on the rise in the West, many find themselves inclined to see the role of myth as being outdated, unappealing, and no longer useful for both individuals and communities. This presentation will give special focus to how myth has functioned and shaped various historical and contemporary Mormon worldviews, as well as how younger generations of Mormons may uniquely utilize such as part of their religious identity. Jackson Washburn is a young Latter-day Saint currently pursuing a major in religious studies at Arizona State. He recently returned from serving in the Armenia, Georgia mission and is a member of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. His interests include studying religion, Mormon history, interfaith activism, traveling, and writing poetry. So let's turn the time over.
So hopefully you don't mind if I'm not at the lectern, because this presentation I'm hoping can be a bit more interactive today. Some audience participation throughout is what I'm hoping to get, because there's quite a few presentations at Sunstone where, you know, it might just be preaching at you, and so I'm hoping that we can generate some discussion during the course of the presentation. So just keep that in mind. I might be inviting you to come up to the mic and share your thoughts on various things. So by participating, you can help this run a lot smoother and better. So as far as the title goes, I just want to clarify, this is not Millennials, Mormonisms, and Meth. That's a different presentation. I'm not qualified to speak on that personally, thank goodness. But you might see it at Sunstone another occasion. I don't know. Maybe that would be worthy of conversation. But thank you for the introduction. Just by a show of hands, I want to know how many of you are familiar with Jana Reese's recent book. You already know. Yeah, I don't even have to, say the title, regarding millennials in the church. She has conducted some very important research and compiled some very important data that I think should be taken into consideration, both on an institutional level by the church and considering the trends and potential futures that exist for oncoming generations in the church, but also for us on a lay level. It's important to understand generationally how different generations within the church are experiencing their Mormonism and practicing it in different ways. Everyone can hear me all right, right? Okay, good. Let me scroll down a bit. Yeah. Today, I'd like to overview several different points of identity that describe myself personally throughout this presentation. That of a millennial. Although that's disputed because I was born in 98. Sometimes the cutoff is 96. I don't know, I'd kind of in between, but I really don't like Generation Z, so. That of a transhumanist, which, this is part of the panel for the Mormon Transhumanist Association, of which I'm a part, and that of a Mormon and a Latter-day Saint, religious identities, which I feel aptly describe myself. All three of these identities caused me to be deeply interested and invested in the importance of what we're going to be talking about. So we live in the year 2019, and we're entering a kind of transition stage that has been decades in the making in regards to the place and role of religious life in the 21st century. a lot of the trends that we've witnessed through the 20th century are now culminating in ways that are deeply affecting religious communities across American society. So although globally religious populations are predicted to rise in comparison to their secular counterparts, so in terms of percentages, actually religion is on the increase globally, although just because of taking into account birth rates and things like that, that would be in parts of the world such as Sub-Saharan Africa, Middle East, different parts, locations which have higher birth rates than are experienced in the more secular West, right? So with rates of religious non-affiliation steadily rising in the West, though, virtually all faith communities are experiencing decreased retention levels as a result. I think this is all very clear. Closer? All right, that's better. The trends that have been observed on national levels by institutions such as Pew Research and the Public Religion Research Initiative, as well as specified studies which focus in on single religious traditions, all demonstrate this. And in the case of Jana Rees, that's kind of what I'm talking about. In the case of Mormonism, the most recent and largest national survey to date is the Next Mormon Survey, which was conducted by Jana Rees and Benjamin Knoll in 2016, the results of which were recently published through Oxford University Press in The Next Mormons, How Millennials Are Changing the LDS Church. In this enlightening volume, through the data compiled by Rees and Knoll, we can observe to a fair degree of accuracy the ways in which millennial members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are comparing to their previous generations on a range of subjects. And with that, we're able to glean insights into generational differences, which can assist us in what directions up-and-coming Latter-day Saints are headed. So as such, my remarks today will be limited to kind of data and history regarding the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, specifically within this setting in the United States. And so that's also important to take into account. This isn't necessarily indicative of Mormonism in a global setting. It's largely Western. So while Latter-day Saints have typically fared off better in terms of retention than their surrounding American counterparts, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has been subject to the same trends and general influences of the secular age. So overall, recent research has revealed through institutions such as Pew, Barna, and others, some interesting points regarding millennials. I'm just going to overview that, and then we can actually get to the fun stuff. Millennials are more likely to leave organized religion, with about a third self-identifying as nuns. We've heard of the nun generation, the not religious. This is more than three times the rate of religious non-affiliation in the silent generation born before 1945. So these trends are on the rise. Despite their lack of interest in religious institutions, in terms of their personal beliefs, they still score very high in a belief in God, heaven, and a kind of willingness to talk about and share their faith. When it comes to both American society and millennials within the church, they're the most racially diverse generation in church/U.S. history, with 43% being non-white. And they're also more likely to support same-sex marriage than previous generations. A lot of this, I imagine, just by participating in American society, you can get a sense of. So they later marry, and they have fewer children than their elders, although parenthood is still very important. Birth rates are falling, and that is going to impact the kind of percentages that these religious or non-religious groups occupy within American society. So now I want to talk about myth, and not meth. I'll try to say myth, because when you think of myth, kind of what's the first thing that comes to mind? Maybe not for yourself, but often when people are using the term myth, how do you think they're using it? What do you get the sense of? You can yell it out. I'll repeat it.
Fictions.
Yeah, fiction, Zeus, like mythology, right? False, something, yeah, something that's not real, right? And so it's often used in a pejorative term, right? If you say that this is a myth, then you're often saying that this is false. So I'm wanting to, in this presentation, kind of reclaim the definition of myth and expand it a bit. While you know you can definitely use myth in that sense, I believe in the field of religious studies that it's far more constructive and nuanced to use a wider definition. Now, the problem is, just as with the word religion, it is hard, essentially impossible, in my opinion, to define what myth is. I am doing religious studies at ASU, and basically my first day in class, the lesson that they really get you to learn is that there's no definition for religion that's completely, you know, all-inclusive. It's such a fluid, abstract concept that words are very difficult to aptly describe it. And there's many instances where, because we come from Western backgrounds, our understanding of religion is colored by centuries of culture and society that influence how we think religion is and what religion should be. Now, just anecdotally, when American... yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. I kind of have to eat the mic, don't I? Right. Yum. So as far as American traders in the 19th century, they're going over to Japan, right? And one of the anecdotes that was shared in my religious studies class was these American traders, they ask the Japanese, what is your religion? What religion do you practice? Well, that concept just doesn't really exist with the Japanese at the time, right? In places such as India and the East, the Western concept of religion, it was very difficult to understand, especially one that's coming from like a Protestant background, right? And so they asked them, what is your religion? The Japanese reply, Shinto. Well, the thing is with Shintoism, that really just means like the way. That's just the way of life. That's the way things are. And so it's very different, and it's a much more fluid category than in the West. So I'm going to share some definitions of myth. So, and I invite you, as I share this, I'm going to stop one by one and invite you to come up, and we can talk about how this might apply within a Mormon context. Are you willing to kind of help me with that? Just whatever comes to mind, too, because I'd like this to be a discussion. So the first one is myth as a source of cognitive categories. What that kind of means is that myth is seen as an explanation for enigmatic phenomena, and it's kind of a way in which the intellect is trying to conceptualize certain aspects of the universe to establish the relationship between these different phenomena. So that's very heady, right? The first thing that comes to mind for me within a Mormon context is different Mormon attempts to grapple with and answer paradox, right? So for instance, one of the most classic examples of that is the relationship between the body and the soul within or the spirit, right? Within Mormonism, we see all three as having very important things to play into our personal individual identity. And so Mormonism attempts to synthesize the three of them and explain the relationship between these three different parts of ourself. Often people use the term spirit and soul to be kind of the same. In Mormonism, we often see that the soul is referred to as the spirit and the body combined. But these categories have been kind of fluid across Mormon history. So can you think of any examples within a Mormon context that might address myth as a source of cognitive category? Yeah.
I was going to say physical attributes, sexuality, and gender. Mm. That the Mormon construct is very, until very recently, those were all tied at the hip. Mm-hmm. And how you looked is what God said you were for gender and sexuality. Mm-hmm. And so I see that.
Yeah, no, that definitely still plays out today a lot in Latter-day Saint discourse, especially. There are varied conversations about whether gender and sex are the same thing or if they're not. They're often used interchangeably in kind of Mormon parlance or Latter-day Saint parlance. So that definitely exists as well. Do you have any other ideas If not, we can move on to the next one. So myth as a form of symbolic expression. This is where myth is kind of placed on par with other creative activities, such as poetry or music. Myth has its own laws, its own reality, its own forms of expression, and it can be looked upon as a projection of the human mind as a symbolic structuring of the world.
The temple.
How so? Do you want to come up and share some thoughts?
Well, I think that the temple is a projection of divine realm and our connecting with divinity through those ordinances,
mm-hmm.
right? So whether those, just that story, that myth of how we get back into God's presence and endowed with, you know, gifts and powers and things
right.
like that.
Yeah, I think that's a great example, the temple, where we progress through different portions. It kind of has a chronological nature to it that addresses who we are, where we come from, where we're going, and that's definitely a way in which ritually we're able to symbolically express these higher myths that Mormonism espouses with its cosmology. So the third one is that myth is a projection of the subconscious. So this is where myth is seen as a relation to a substratum shared partly by all humans, and they're often similar to each other in terms of race, nation, culture, other ways. So this message is disguised and condensed, and it's the projection of the subconscious that is controlled partly by tradition and partly by elementary facts of life. So when I think of Mormonism and different projections of the subconscious, right, often, you know, perhaps you could tie gender into that, different gender constructs, how, especially coming from 19th century or Victorian era views on sexuality, on gender roles, right? We see kind of a traditional projection of patriarchal and matriarchal values that are often seen as divinely endorsed. Does anyone have any other ideas about maybe... Yeah.
I don't know if this fits into the last topic or this one, the myth of the membership's construct that when people are speaking in general conference, mm-hmm. that they're speaking for God,
mm-hmm.
that mechanism that because of that time, because of that symbolism of location, that there's that deity transformative communication to the people. Does that fit in the last topic or this?
Yeah, so the last topic was, let me just scroll up, myth as a form of symbolic expression. And this one is a projection of the subconscious. I think maybe this would fit better in this category because you might be able to bring in themes of authority, of what people... they see their best selves or kind of their ideal selves in their leaders. And if not their leaders, then definitely I think it's fair to say that Christianity as a whole projects kind of this subconscious of the ideal human in the person of Jesus Christ, the kind of perfected individual that's all-loving. Reza Aslan addressed this the other night, which I really appreciated. He said a lot of things that I think are very in line with what I'm talking about today. The fourth one is myth is an integrating factor in man's adaptation to life, and myth is like a worldview. This one varies throughout time. There's been quite a few different mythic worldviews in Mormonism across its history. I think the first one that we could probably start off with, it might be safe to start with Joseph Smith's own worldview. That was influenced by the Protestantism that he was surrounded by. It was influenced by the early American folk magic worldview. And so in ways, various scholars such as Michael Quinn and others have attempted to look at Joseph Smith through the context of his worldview to see how that worldview might have colored his revelations, his experience with Mormonism, and the things that he was involved with. there's other worldviews as well. Anyone want to come up and, yeah, go ahead.
Maybe this idea of we're a persecuted people, like that, you know, we were driven and pushed and forced and it's us and them, that kind of, you know, that's a very common thing, a lot of faith communities, but that's a myth in some regards. It's a way of viewing the world. We are other and we're being attacked.
Right, yeah, that's a very in-group, out-group type model, right? Yeah.
So Jackson, I'm thinking this more of the context. Read that last part again, what your myth as what is kind of a universal construct?
As a worldview. So just the kind of stuff that I've wrote down for this is
universally,
that, in myths, man is faced with fundamental problems of society, culture, and nature. Myths offer opportunities of selecting different elements which satisfy both individual tendencies and social necessities, and from these elements it is possible to create an individual but at the same time traditional way of viewing the world.
So I think your law codes from the beginning of time that attribute these law codes to divinity, right? So it's we seek for higher law and order. We want structure.
Right.
We want an ultimate lawgiver. We want to know what's ultimately right and what's not.
Yeah.
We want social structure, which is very important, right? So I think these myths are, they're foundational.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, Bryce?
This may fall within the previous of projection of subconscious or within like a cohesive worldview, but the idea of like a Joseph Smith's magic worldview still pervades our collective Mormon consciousness today when we see that everything is an interplay or a battle, a constant battlefield between the divine and the adversary. If something is going on in my life that I feel opposed to or like if I'm hitting every single red light, why is there something that I'm doing wrong in my life?
Yeah.
And then you realize that, you know, a car flies through a red light that if you wouldn't have stopped at the previous red light, you would have been hit by that car. Oh, well, that's the divine. That's an expression of the divine, right? So there's the constant interplay that everything in the world is moved and shaped by these forces that are transcendent and can be controlled or influenced by our piety and our devotion to the divine forces that hopefully benefit us and our abstinence from anything that could be considered of the adversarial forces.
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on with that. Now, we probably have kind of a diverse crowd here coming from a lot of different backgrounds and occupying different worldviews, but How many of you, if you do come from like a Mormon or Latter-day Saint background, whether currently or in the past, maybe you lost your keys and said a prayer and, you know, you were able to find your keys after that prayer was said? We've certainly heard our fair share of anecdotes about things like that. So I think that's spot on, Bryce. That's a very powerful mythic worldview that largely pervades society today, and specifically, it's not just a Mormon thing, too, right? This pervades really the Judeo-Christian tradition, but many other traditions as well. I think it's apt to put it as the law of the harvest, more or less. What goes around comes around, and for the people that hold on to that kind of worldview, right? When things do go awry, you might be concerned with yourself that, you know, you have made a mistake. If things are going your way, then, perhaps that's an indication of your own personal righteousness or good standing with the divine. So I definitely agree with that. Yeah.
So this is actually a really fascinating topic to me. I love this.
Yeah.
And I'm actually a big fan of Shinto. So this is really fun to kind of contrast these things. So what I'm trying to maybe draw the distinction out here is, so if I pray and I, to find my keys and I find my keys, I'm trying to see that as a myth versus, you know, as a contrast to literal, true belief. Because if I found my keys and I'm attributing that to a god, I'm not necessarily thinking of that in terms of a myth. I'm not thinking as it just a symbolic way, but in a literal sense, I prayed and I literally found my keys.
For sure.
And so how do we draw that distinction or that contrast between how we're defining myth versus literal? And this kind of comes back to my whole my problem with the Mormon worldview is that there's such a requirement to kind of see it in a literal sense versus a mythic sense. So how do we draw that distinction there when we're talking about it in terms of a myth? Like, how would we define those things?
Yeah, no, I think that that it can be very difficult for sure, because I think there's individuals who don't necessarily carry that specific belief, or let's just say any belief, right? They don't necessarily espouse that themselves, but there might still be value that they see in the belief. Does that make sense, right? Essentially, I think the way I think about it is that these different beliefs, whether they're religious or not, are often subsets or expressions of, you know, a myth that lays behind them. Because the myth is kind of the force that gives it meaning. It gives it purpose and sets it into a framework that the person derives value from. And in the case of espousing a particular belief, I personally see it as whether consciously or unconsciously, they find value, or there's something about that myth that makes it worth holding on to. But there's also other times where just by virtue of growing up in a particular place, we all will be subject to different myths or different beliefs. And I know for myself, being born in America at the time that I was, being raised in the religious context that I was, there's different forces that shaped me that I didn't choose, right? But that still consciously or unconsciously affect me today. I'm definitely wouldn't claim to say that I'm aware of all of them. But kind of the point of my presentation here, by the end of it, I'm hoping to have us all think about what these myths might be, these forces that drive our decisions, that influence why we think and act in the way that we do. Yeah.
I didn't realize it till like just now in this presentation, but I feel like myths, whether we're in a religion or not, as humans, they justify our existence. And it's like the universe or God somehow has a role in our lives and cares about us. Mm-hmm. And is shaping our reality in some form or another. And I kind of laughed at myself just a moment ago because, like, my wife and I, like, left Mormonism about 5 years ago. I mean, mm-hmm. I was, you know, straight-laced, true blue Mormon, went on a mission and everything, mm-hmm. BYU graduate, everything, but left it 5 years ago. And I'm agnostic / atheist, somewhere in between there.
Right.
But I'll find myself, my wife will be like, oh my gosh, a ladybug landed on me. Look up the spirit animal definition. Oh, that means change is ahead. And it's like, oh, the universe knows you exist and it cares about you. And it's somehow like sending good things your way.
Yeah.
You know, and even outside of Mormonism, we're still looking for justification for our existence, and I think myth has a huge role there.
Yeah, no, for sure. You reminded me of a funny part of my family. My mom also left the LDS Church a while back, and so, you know, she wouldn't say that she believes in it or identifies as a Mormon anymore. And a conversation that I had with her and my brother was regarding her going to get her palms read. You know, I don't know if it was for fun or not, right? But my brother was kind of confronting her on it, saying, Mom, you don't believe in patriarchal blessings. Why are you getting your palms read, you know? Kind of making them out to be a functional equivalent. And it was just kind of a funny exchange there because, like you said, we still look for that that meaning. We still look for that kind of justification for existence, that divine guidance. Even if we don't necessarily think about it as divine, a lot of people think of, like, what is my purpose in life, right? And there's various individuals who occupy secular worldviews that still are able to define their own purpose in the same way or in a powerful way for them that as religious people do. So these exist. Myth, I definitely feel, permeates both religion and non-religion because in Reza Aslan's previous presentations and a lot of the stuff that he talks about, he might talk about the myth of gender equality, right? That is a myth of itself And, you know, our brains are kind of programmed to think that's a falsehood. I'm not saying that, right? But it's something that gives meaning, that drives action. And for the individuals who are maybe advocating for various issues regarding gender equality, they find meaning and value in it enough to devote their life to it, right? So that is kind of the myth that is influencing them. George, did you want to come up?
Yeah, I'm trying not to heckle you too much, but I wanted to go back on the, you know,
yeah, no worries.
The Lost Keys example and the comment that was mentioned that it's because they believe it is literal truth. Mm-hmm. The value that that has is that if I pray, then I will get an answer and I'll be able to find my keys. Once you lose that belief of that literal truth, then that myth no longer has meaning. And so I think, right, you know, as we're going through, we want to say something like, you know, myths aren't just fictional, they aren't just false, but we have this underlying system that we are socialized into that says that the value of these beliefs, the value of this Book of mm-hmm. Mormon, is that it is a historical document. Mm-hmm. And if it is a historical document, then we can do this daisy chain of, you know, Joseph Smith was a prophet and the church is true, blah, blah, blah. And so I'm looking to see, you know, in an era where increasingly people and millennials especially are saying, well, it's not historically true.
Right.
It's not literally true. Mm-hmm. How do you connect the dots of justifying why people would want to stay in that? So, for example, you mentioned gender equality as a myth. Gender equality is a myth because, in my experience, it makes the world a better place.
Right.
So how would I justify a Mormon myth of, you know, homophobia and transphobia and all these things? Well, if it's the literal way that the universe works and God just is a, you know, homophobe and that's just the way things are, then we just have to accept that. But if not, why would we stick around with it?
Right. And, you know, more or less, I think we're in agreement here because I'm asking us to question what our myths are for the purpose of making the world a better place. It is my view that as we're more aware of what these myths are, we are better able to judge whether or not they're actually worthy of us holding them and, you know, acting out on beliefs in them in the first place. To your point with the Book of Mormon, for individuals who, you know, have varying views regarding its historicity, let's say they take a non-historical view to it and believe that it's a 19th century document, which it is, even if you believe it is historical, right? There's still plenty of people who find value in it in terms of the truth, you know, various maybe moral teachings or things like that, right? And so where, I don't know, a Latter-day Saint who believes it's historical might justify their belief in its truth claims because it's historical or because, you know, they see it connected to the divine in some way. Another might be able to still, you know, espouse those same moral claims that it's making, but they're coming from a different angle with it, which you pointed out there. There's other definitions of myth as well. I won't go through all of them since we're a little short on time. But one that I think plays big here is myth as legitimization of social institutions. Where have we seen that? With maybe the LDS Church, maybe, you know, whatever restorationist sect that you choose to affiliate with. For individuals who believe in the mythic narrative, and the other thing too is that myths can take the form of stories, as I think we're very well aware, right? For individuals who espouse kind of the preach my gospel story of the priesthood authority being lost in early Christian times and then finally restored to Joseph Smith through the laying on of hands by Peter, James, and John, that very much functions as a mythic story, which gives legitimacy and authority to, I guess it depends on which restorationist sect you you know belong to, but for my own experience within Latter-day Saint context, that's often seen as people often use that in my faith tradition as legitimizing why they choose to be in the church because they believe it has the authority because it has that priesthood authority. Any comments on that? Yeah.
Kind of along the same lines as human beings, we love to tell stories and mm-hmm. We're like little myth creators. What do you think the role is as far as like the human ego in creating myths?
I think we kind of touched on that as far as the subconscious and projecting our various ideals and values into these myths that we espouse. And the other thing, too, is that these myths don't just come out of a vacuum. They're created by humans, right? And I'm not saying that it's impossible for there to be divine influence in there, right? But these myths are created by humans in a very real sense. We perpetuate them, we find value in them, and they influence our lives. And for various myths that humans might either create or espouse, where we project, you know, our own ego. And I see this outside of Mormonism, of course. I often say that the kind of person you are very much reflects the God that you worship. Or you could take that backwards. The God you worship really influences the kind of person that you are. You know, if you have a view in a more wrathful, you know, justice-driven God that is very harsh, comes down heavy in judgment, I imagine your behavior is probably going to reflect the same way. I think of maybe the Westboro Baptist Church, for instance. I think their understanding of God is going to look very different, theologically speaking, from maybe a liberal mainline Protestant church that would emphasize other values of their deity. Jared?
Yeah, I like this conversation. I think the waters get a little bit muddied because I think I'm going to speak that I would probably guess most people in this room understand Israelite creation or Israelite origin myths, right? Mm-hmm. Tower of Babel, flood.
Right.
I think those things are probably understood as stories, not literal history, mm-hmm. right? But then if we jump to Peter, James, and John, given Joseph Smith the priesthood, that's harder, right? I mean, if you want to go there and say that's just myth.
Right.
So that's it depends on how we're defining myth, right?
No, of course, which is what I'm saying. It's so difficult to actually define myth.
Because myth in an academic setting obviously isn't necessarily bad. But if that's myth in the same sense that Israelite origin myths are myths, then that radically redefines Mormonism, right? So it's a radical shifting gears that you see happening within Mormonism, which is really the only way to solve Mormonism's problems in my mind, which I think is probably the way it goes. But it's still confusing because that just Western civilization as a whole has always seen the Bible as literal history, mm-hmm. not myth. It was seen as literal history, right? And now with education and modernity, we're changing completely our views on all these things, including within the church.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, do you want to come up?
It's easy to mythologize ancient things.
Yes.
Can you mythologize restoration events?
I see people do it. I wouldn't say it's necessarily held by the majority, right? But that is the question in the case of demythologizing and recognizing what our myths are, we apply different values, perhaps, based off where they're coming from and the proximity, right? It hits a little bit harder to home, you know, if an individual, a Latter-day Saint, were to say that the Book of Mormon is not historical, but yes, they're willing to recognize, like Jared said, that, you know, perhaps the early Genesis account isn't necessarily guided by literal history, right? So I think of that as an interesting phenomenon. I want to study that more within my experience upcoming with school, how that works, because you would think the mental process behind that would be very much the same. You know, there's kind of the commitment or it just becomes a lot more personal, perhaps, and that's why it's more difficult. But I wouldn't say it's necessarily impossible because there are individuals that I've seen online or otherwise that still very much espouse a Latter-day Saint or Mormon worldview. It's going to be look very different from current LDS orthodoxy, but because they still find value, meaning, and kind of a heritage-based association with these different unique restorationist myths, right? They're willing to, you know, read them devotionally. They're willing to teach them to their kids. They're willing to participate in an institution which values them as well. At the end of the day, it is fairly subjective how you solve these things and approach these matters, right? Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm really, like, open-minded and like to have a dialogue with active LDS people, coworkers, friends, old college buddies. And I've had a lot of conversations lately where, you know, people like you who are like, you don't have your blinders on.
Well, I still have blinders.
Okay, well,
I'm just blind to them.
Your blinders are a lot smaller. Yeah. It seems. So, like, all of our myths that we have in our mind are like dominoes, right? That go like tipping over, as like it just becomes more impossible to deny that what you thought was a truth is actually a myth.
Mm-hmm.
And so those dominoes go tipping over. Historicity of the Book of Mormon, for example. But I was talking with a friend, there's his one myth, the biggest domino of all, is his spiritual experience, testimony. That I had that, you know, unless I have an equally powerful spiritual experience to knock that over and tell me that I should be outside of the church, it doesn't matter what other dominoes fall over, what other truths flip into myths because of more truth coming out.
Yeah, so I just want to pause you there.
Yeah.
Because, like in the statement, these truths become myths, right?
Mm-hmm.
It almost seems like you're saying these truths become falsehoods, right?
That's yeah, kind of the, I guess I'm limiting.
Which I'm not saying that's an invalid way of using myth, right?
Yeah.
Just want to clarify
aware that. Of that.
Yeah, I'm trying
to limit the definition of myth.
Yeah,
I see that. And I think there's value in looking closer at the method at which the church tells you to find out that it's true.
Mm.
Muslims pray to, you know that, you know, they you know, people in several religions use the same method to find out that their contradictory beliefs are also true. You know, they can't all be true together. And if we're all using the same method to find out that ours is truth, then, I mean, there's, you get my point.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, to a sense, you're speaking about, often, you know, I just came off my mission, right? So I understand what you're talking about, in that, when I would sit down with individuals and invite them to read the Book of Mormon and pray about it to know if it's true, right? What are we meaning when we say that it's true? For many people, that entails that it's a factual historical account, or that generally the storyline is tied to actual historical events, that it's perhaps metaphysical claims regarding the person of God, the person of Jesus Christ are true, that it's a book that is inspired. I think that can mean different things to different people as well, right? So for me personally, you know, I wouldn't at all say that people can't pray to know truth. The interpretation of what those truths are and what's being validated, I see as a very subjective experience, right? Where I have seen people pray to know if the Book of Mormon is true. Well, they don't join the LDS Church. They just feel that it has good teachings and that it's something valid that they should, you know, live by in certain respects. Do you have any experience with that,
yeah,
Peter?
I mean, case in point, like, I believe in the Book of Mormon, but I'm not a member of the LDS Church.
Yeah.
Technically, I am. Yeah. Like, for me, reframing things, I think myth. Let's go back to the Peter, James, and John example.
Right.
Like, I don't buy that myth, but I do still believe in authority.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I've had to reframe a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, where does that, you know, I live in a Judeo-Christian worldview. There are myths that I accept as truths, but I understand that they're myths.
Mm-hmm.
You know
right.
what I'm saying? So, yeah, and like the whole how we come to know truth, that's a myth too. You know, like those are,
yeah,
those things are myths that give those answers power. You know?
Yeah. So. My belief that an individual can ask in a spiritual practice questions to the divine and receive some kind of guidance or answer, that's a myth that I live by and that I'm, you know, espouse and I am affected by. The thing is, like I'm saying, awareness of our myths doesn't necessarily predicate that we no longer find value in those myths, that we no longer espouse those myths. You've mentioned reframing that went on in your individual case, And I imagine there's a fair amount of individuals that could probably relate to that. Okay.
And that's where, you know, my realization over the last 12 years of my journey is coming to the realization that it is all myth, and that in general conference, when things are spoken of revelation, that is a myth for them, and that I see for myself that it's all myth. And myth meaning that it is stories that we're telling each other. I don't even strive to go through and say true, capital T, true, and those types of things anymore at all. That it's myth, and then it's really how I choose to interpret that myth to navigate my life and my journey, and then allowing others to have that same myth within themselves, whether they choose to have that be capital T truth, lower T truth, or otherwise, and whatever that journey travels them through. So I think for myself, that's in my own personal navigation of myth, is it's helped me, even if it makes it painful when I feel that others are portraying their myth as capital T truth, and then causing sometimes harm to others due to that mechanism.
Yeah, so. Go ahead. Yeah.
I recognize that there may be different definitions for the word myth. At the same time, I think in general, myth has a pejorative sense to it.
Right.
That
often
someone
it
has been duped, that it's a silliness, that it's a showing of weakness to adhere to that belief. That concerns me. I would not feel comfortable approaching someone who is Jewish and who believes in a very literal historical approach to Genesis or the creation and say, you're just believing in a myth.
Right. Well, I wouldn't be comfortable with that either, unless I defined what I was meaning. Right.
Right. And so I'm personally somewhat uncomfortable describing so many other things as myths that someone just believes. I'm comfortable respecting others in their beliefs, or even that they have doubts.
Yeah.
But the word myth is one that I'm uncomfortable with.
It carries a lot of baggage, right? It can be a very loaded term.
It's very pejorative. So it concerns me using that to describe any kind of belief, whether it's in spiritual experiences that one has had, or belief in recognizing that something that someone says really has value and has truth that reflects something from God that is a message to us. So I believe in everyone having the opportunity to elect and to choose and to feel, but I'm concerned about the term.
Right, yeah. No, and your concern is definitely valid.
This is a really interesting topic for me, because I myself grew up my whole life being told I was a Lamanite. This was an origin story that was attributed to me and to other people, myself, who have can trace their ancestry back to the indigenous people here in the Americas. But now that I have a different concept of the Book of Mormon, and that we know now a lot more information on genetics and the origins of the Native people in the Americas, I've had to renegotiate my position with the Book of Mormon. I'm kind of curious to see how others like myself, those with Native American background, with indigenous backgrounds in Mexico, Central America, how they're going to renegotiate that position with the Book of Mormon as this concept of genetics and Lamanites gets further developed.
Yeah, and that's hard for me to speak on authoritatively, of course, because I myself am not Native, and I haven't wrestled with those on such a personal level as perhaps you have, right? I do imagine that if there is such a renegotiation, that it should come from Native voices, from Native peoples, who decide what the in what way they redefine their identity with the Book of Mormon, with their faith community, and with their understanding of history. They're going to have to reframe it potentially, such as Peter mentioned earlier. I don't necessarily have a great answer for that. Yeah.
So Just going back to the Shinto thing for a second.
Yeah.
So my perspective on Shinto actually, I think, is sort of a contrast that helps illustrate the kind of the what feels like is the main problem going on here. Mm-hmm. When I think about Shinto, there's not one part of it that I take literally. Mm. I don't think of Amaterasu as a real person. She's a representation of the sun, and you know, Izanagi and Izanami and the Kojiki, and you know, all of these concepts are just non-literal metaphorical concepts to explain this. But it's precisely because I do not take it literally that I can take it seriously. Mm. And so if someone was expecting me to take those concepts literally, I would have to leave. You know, I can't enjoy this conversation anymore because you're wanting me to believe in Amaterasu. And so I think that then maybe what the real kind of conundrum for Mormonism is that they kind of are putting you into a box where you kind of need to take it literally. And so when we're talking about like the millennial question of like how are they dealing with this problem, they're not dealing it with the same way that like a millennial Japanese kid is taking this, right? Mm-hmm. I guess I shouldn't say kid. Millennials are not really kids, but they don't really have the same conundrum. Because they're not being asked to take it literally. There's no very small group of people in Japan who mm-hmm. consider those stories to be literal stories. Mm-hmm. And so the question really becomes then, how in this navigation, how do we deal with the fact that they're basically wanting you to take it, or almost requiring you to take it literally in order to exist within the community, within the whatever?
Yeah, and that's something that makes it so difficult for potentially progressive voices or individuals who no longer espouse those kind of literal beliefs that you mentioned to find participation in space for themselves, representation within the Latter-day Saint community, because that's something that collectively the community and institutionally, those are the values of literalness, that these are real things that we're talking about in a factual sense, perhaps in a metaphysical sense, right? Those are by many people are seen as kind of the key upon which the rest of Mormonism is valid or it's not, right? So, but that in itself is a perspective. It's a paradigm and kind of a its own worldview regarding these issues. And so that's not necessarily one where individuals have yet in a large sense, I've seen plenty of people do it on a personal level, right? But collectively, right, we haven't yet seen that collective reframing. So, yeah.
This kind of dovetails off of the previous comment. And Jackson, I want to hear your commentary, your perspective on this specifically. Much of the conversation has been focused on the internal view of myth. I am also interested on the external forces that myths create, because mm-hmm. myths can be so incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is the myth of human dominionism can completely and entirely supplant any efforts to curtail the destructive force of the human hand on the world, right? People believing in myths believe that everybody should believe in their myth.
Yeah.
Those are very powerful things, and for a person like myself who tries to believe in as few myths as possible, I don't have my own myth to try and impose on other people or impose on politics or impose on, you know, neighbors when I'm knocking on their door. I don't have those tools. I don't have an external force of myth that a lot of people, that the majority of people in America do have. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to hear your commentary on the external forces of myths when they are so deeply internalized and often tied so deeply with personal identity.
Yeah, Reza spoke about how religion, and in this case I would say myth, likely has the equal power to do good in the world as it does, you know, to justify and influence individuals to do bad. Different sides of a coin. I'll give you how this influences a Latter-day Saint kind of world, a real example. So in the New Mormon Study, or the Next Mormon Survey, in 2016, they asked whether respondents, individuals in the survey, felt that the ban on individuals of African descent was inspired of God and was God's will for the church until 1978. So respondents were given a 5-point scale of possible responses, with the upshot being that nearly 2/3 of self-identified Latter-day Saints say that they either know or believe that the ban was God's will. This, of course, is happening simultaneously with the church disavowing previous racial justifications for the priesthood and temple ban. And as a matter of fact, one of the surprises with it is that when it came to African-American respondents in the group, 67% of African-Americans who were respondents know or believe that the priesthood temple ban was God's will, which is actually 6 points higher in the survey than it was for whites. When was it done? 2016. Yeah. So, you know, of course, as far as sample sizes and things like that go, that probably skews the data just a little bit. But this is one place where these racial myths that largely came from a Protestant worldview were espoused by Mormon leaders and, you know, the Mormon community for quite a long time. And in ways, they then turned to Mormon texts and, you know, read these myths and worldviews into those texts. Or, you know, you could argue that they were already present in those texts. And that's where you get various justifications of the racial ban that existed, such as that individuals of African descent were neutral in the war in heaven. That's an instance where we actually have an on-the-ground issue, and they create a myth to justify that, right? So I think it's very interesting, but that's why I'm arguing that we need to be so aware of what our myths are to understand why we're making the decisions that we do and what is influencing us to respond to various on-the-ground, real-world situations. I believe with greater awareness of what our myths are that we can do more good in the world and be more sensitive to the positive and negative repercussions of what's going on. Okay.
That was actually right in line with what I was going to say. I was in, and this brother here, you know, you want to be respectful of myth, right? And I think that myth, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in academic settings, myth doesn't have the negative connotation.
No.
It's used all the time in academia, and it's not negative at all.
Yeah, so it's pretty neutral.
It's in a lay setting, you may see that as, you know, offensive, and it can be offensive. We have to be sensitive to those things. But if we're not willing to say, like you alluded to, Jackson, that our myth that blacks were less valiant, right, in the pre-existence, or perhaps the myth of Native Americans, we reappropriate, you know, Native Amerindians to, you know, Israelite origins, right?
Yeah.
When clearly DNA evidence tells us not the case. So if we never admit where our myths are wrong, then there's no progress.
Right.
So we have to be willing to say some myths are okay and respectable, others aren't.
They don't work.
They don't work. So we have to be willing to be self-critical, right, without getting too offended on those things. Right. Otherwise, there's no progress in these things.
Yeah, I agree. And there's various ways to soften the term myth, too, if, you know, there are individuals that are concerned about it, or perhaps the audience that you're speaking to would be concerned with it. You might use sacred narrative. You might use theology. You might use worldview. A lot of these, I guess you could say, are synonymous, depending on how you define them, with myth, right? So they're interchangeable, and people generally don't always react as strongly to them, right? George?
Yeah, I think another way of putting this is that when we think of it in terms of truth or false, and we say, you know, just a myth, we ignore the pragmatic function that they have. So the myth that, you know, blacks were less valiant in, you know, the preexistence or whatever, justified the actions of, you know, thousands of millions of LDS, and, you know, it still justifies, you know, racism today, regardless of whether we disavow that. And so, you know, even if you think, you know, the Book of Mormon was made up and this church is made up, we have this state that would not exist but for, you know, this myth. And so myths have cash value in that they they motivate action and that they create things, whether good or bad.
Right. Yeah. And this spans religious and non-religious societies. The myths that shape and force our world, I think, deserve to be studied and, you know, recognized on their own merit. And by doing so, we can better, we can more responsibly choose what our myths are and what exactly we're endorsing. So, is that a good place to
Yeah.
And there? We're all right. Well, thank you so much for participating. I thought that was pretty interactive, and I enjoyed it. So thank you for coming, and I'd be happy to talk more about this in the future. Thank you.
We'd like to thank Jackson Washburn and the Mormon Transhumanist Association for sponsoring this presentation. Mormon teachings about humans becoming gods connect with transhumanist ideas about using technology to enhance humanity. Please visit their booth across the hall and meet with a representative or join and learn more about Mormon transhumanism. Thank you for coming.